Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, to kick things off today, I want to pose a biological paradox to you that honestly just stopped me in my tracks.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about. And yeah, it is completely wild.
So did you know that in early human embryos, over 80% of blastocysts?
And for context, that's the microscopic ball of cells that forms just days after fertilization.
Yeah, exactly. Over 80% of them feature what's called mosaic aneuploidy, which basically means their cells have a completely chaotic, imbalanced number of chromosomes.
Yeah, it's a total genetic mess.
It really is. Yet somehow the developing body successfully identifies and, you know, depletes these defective cells to produce a perfectly healthy baby.
It's an incredible cleanup job, honestly. The body acts like this incredibly efficient bouncer in those early days. But the flip side of that paradox is what happens decades later.
Right.
Because that exact same chromosomal chaos, that same aneuploidy, is actually found in 90% of human solid tumors.
Which is just staggering. I mean, in an embryo, the body roots it out.
Mm.
But in a tumor, it thrives and totally takes over.
Exactly. And that completely begs the central question for today's deep dive.
Which is, what really happens when a cell ends up with the wrong amount of DNA? And how do its neighboring cells react to this, you know, this genetic imbalance?
Yeah, and answering that question requires a massive leap in how we actually study living tissues. I mean, we really have to look past the individual cell and start examining the neighborhood dynamics.
Definitely. And today we celebrate the work of the team at the Institute for Research in Biomedicine, or IRB Barcelona, who have really advanced our understanding of how living tissues identify and eliminate genetically imbalanced cells.
Yeah, they did some phenomenal work. And, you know, to appreciate the sheer scale of what they achieved, we kind of have to understand the historical hurdle of studying aneuploidy in the first place.
Right, let's break that down.
So, in simple terms, aneuploidy is having an abnormal number of chromosomes, or even just missing or extra segments of one chromosome.
Because normally you have two copies of everything.
Exactly, two copies. So aneuploidy means you might have one copy or you might have three. And systemically, it is devastating. I mean, it's a major driver of miscarriages, developmental disorders, and obviously cancer.
But studying exactly how it destroys tissue at that tiny microscopic level has been like incredibly frustrating for researchers, hasn't it?
Oh, massively frustrating. Because historically, scientists have been studying this mostly in a petri dish.
Right, just taking lab-grown cells and forcing them to scramble their DNA during cell division.
Yeah, that was the standard for a long time. But cultured cells living in a nutrient broth are totally isolated. They're basically floating in a highly artificial environment.
No physical pressure or anything.
Right, no spatial constraints. So they don't reflect the complex physical neighbor-to-neighbor interactions that happen in vivo, like inside a living growing organ.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And furthermore, cultured cells undergo selective pressures over time. They actually adapt to the stress of aneuploidy and mutate to tolerate it.
Wait, really? So they change themselves to survive it?
Exactly. So by the time we actually study them in the lab, we are looking at survivors. We're completely missing the immediate real-world reaction of the tissue.
Oh, wow. I mean, that makes total sense. If you want to understand how a neighborhood reacts to a noisy neighbor, you can't just put the noisy neighbor alone on an island. You have to actually watch the neighborhood.
That's a great way to put it. And the mission here was to build a groundbreaking experimental model to do exactly that.
Okay, so how do they do it?
Well, the researchers wanted to see exactly what happens in a living tissue when perfectly healthy euploid cells, meaning cells with normal DNA, are suddenly forced to interact with aneuploid cells right next door.
Side by side.
Yeah. So they turned to the fruit fly, Drosophila, and specifically they focused on the growing epithelial tissues of the fly's eye and wing primordium.
Okay, let's quickly define primordium for you listening. That's essentially the larval tissue that rapidly multiplies to eventually build the adult organs, like the eye or the wing.
Right.
Correct. Yeah, these tissues grow exponentially during the larval stage, which makes them the perfect bustling neighborhood to observe.
A really active construction zone.
Exactly. And to create the genetic imbalances precisely where and when they wanted, the team utilized a technology based on the FLPFRT recombination system.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm picturing this mechanism correctly, because it's kind of wild.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers place specific target sequences, the FRTs, at exact locations on a chromosome, right?
Yep, that's the first step.
And then they introduce an enzyme called flipase, which basically acts like microscopic scissors to cut and swap the DNA at those exact FRT sites.
You've got it perfectly. But the true innovation here is how they evolved those molecular scissors into a technique called the twin spot generator, or TSG.
Twin spot generator.
Okay.
Yeah, they designed it to perfectly mimic real-life cell division errors. Think about normal cell division, right? A cell copies its DNA perfectly, so both new daughter cells have the exact same genetic material.
Right.
Well, the twin spot generator forces a highly specific error during the G2 phase of the cell cycle.
And that's that critical final checkpoint right before a cell physically splits in two, right?
Exactly.
Okay, let's try an analogy here. Imagine a factory printing a 2-volume instruction manual. A machine jams right at the end of the line. A whole chapter gets ripped out of volume A and accidentally glued into volume B.
I love that.
Right. And then they get shipped out in the exact same box.
That captures the reciprocal nature of the error perfectly. The result is immediate and it's localized. So one daughter cell loses a specific chunk of DNA. We call this a segmental monosomy.
Because it only has one copy of those genes instead of the normal two.
Right. And because that missing chunk doesn't just, you know, magically disappear, it gets inherited by the neighboring twin cell. So that second cell gains the exact same chunk, creating a segmental trisomy, meaning it has three copies of those genes.
So now you have these two twin cells born at the exact same moment, sitting physically right next to each other in a living organ.
Side by side.
One is missing a chapter, one has a duplicate chapter. And to watch this unfold, the researchers used fluorescent markers to track them, right?
Yeah, tagging the monosomic cells with a red protein and the trisomic cells with the green protein.
Wow, so it provides a flawless visual map of the cellular neighborhood.
It really does, and the scale of what they achieved with this mapping is totally unprecedented. I mean, they didn't just snip out one or two isolated genes.
No.
No, they generated these segmental aneuploidies across massive chromosomal regions, encompassing up to 1,750 genes.
Wait, 1,750, that is roughly 12% of the entire fly genome.
Yeah, it's huge.
That's just an enormous chunk of data to suddenly scramble.
And it is highly relevant for humans, too. The researchers point out that a 20,750 gene segment is actually comparable to an average human chromosome. Yeah, for context, human chromosomes range from about 234 genes on chromosome 21 up to over 2,000 genes on chromosome 1. So studying a block of genes this massive in the fly gives us direct insights into full chromosome imbalances in humans.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
So with this microscopic arena built, they could finally watch these twin cells battle it out in real time. And the first major finding challenged a basic assumption I've held for years.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we constantly hear that extra chromosomes, trisomies, are incredibly toxic to a cell. Like Down syndrome is a trisomy. Cancer is full of them. But the researchers found that these segmental trisomies, cells carrying up to 1,500 extra genes, showed absolutely no major growth impairment on their own.
None. It is a shocking resilience. When looking purely at the cell autonomous effect, meaning how the cell behaves in isolation, those green chromosomic clones grew just fine.
That is so weird.
Right. It sharply contrasts with what we often see in yeast or human cell lines grown in a dish, where extra chromosomes cause massive proteotoxic stress.
And proteotoxic stress is basically a toxic buildup of misfolded proteins that slows down growth, right?
Exactly. It gunks up the works. But here, in vivo, an extra 1,500 genes didn't significantly drag them down at all.
Wait, so why are they seemingly immune to that stress in the living tissue? Does the organ somehow buffer the extra protein production?
That remains an open, pivotal question in the field. It could just be a matter of time, honestly. In a rapidly growing larval tissue, the cells simply don't divide enough times over a 72-hour window for the negative effects of the trisomy to compound and become visible.
Ah, so they're on a ticking clock.
Maybe. Alternatively, interactions with neighboring normal cells might be providing some sort of unidentified protective effect.
Fascinating.
But while the trisomies were unexpectedly robust, the monosomies, the cells missing the DNA, told a completely different story.
Yeah, for the cells missing a chunk of DNA, it was an immediate, fatal flaw. Losing just a few hundred genes drastically crippled them. They formed tiny clusters, or they were just completely wiped out of the tissue.
Yeah, and the mechanism driving this fatal flaw is a biological concept called haploinsufficiency.
Haploinsufficiency.
Right. Normally, two copies of a gene produce a specific necessary dose of a protein. If you lose one copy, you naturally produce half the dose.
Makes sense.
Now, for many of the genes in our bodies, half a dose is plenty. The cell compensates and it survives. But for a specific subset of crucial genes, half a dose actually causes the cellular machinery to physically collapse.
And the paper highlights a really stark example of this with a gene called RPL26, didn't they?
They did. So RPL26 is a ribosomal protein gene. Ribosomes are basically the physical protein factories of the cell. If you only have one copy of RPL26, your protein factories are fundamentally broken.
And these are historically known in fly genetics as minute genes, right?
Exactly. So the cell's internal economy just grinds to a halt. It experiences massive proteotoxic stress because it cannot translate proteins properly or on time, leading to a huge buildup of garbage inside the cell.
Yikes. So if the cell with the monosomy is struggling that badly, and its protein factories are failing, you'd think it would just quietly wither away.
You would think so.
But the absolute core discovery of this paper shows that these cells do not die in a vacuum. The tissue actively polices itself. The researchers basically documented a brutal microscopic turf war.
Yeah, the scientific term for it is cell competition. And it's this highly evolved fitness sensing mechanism. The tissue constantly compares the relative health of neighboring cells.
Like a constant performance review.
Basically, cells with defects that lower their metabolic fitness are deemed losers. And they are actively killed off by the fitter winner cells surrounding them.
Yeah.
And the researchers categorize this competition into distinct, really fascinating types. We can start with what they call lethal competition.
Okay, lethal competition. That's what happens to that struggling cell missing the RPL26 gene, right?
Right.
When that monosomic cell is surrounded by normal euploid cells, it struggles and grows slowly.
Yeah.
But when it is surrounded by its trisomic twin, the cell that got the extra copy of the DNA, the situation escalates from a struggle to an outright execution.
It really does.
The trisomic cells actively drive the monosomic cells into total cell death.
Yeah, the trisomic twin acts as an enforcer. And the researchers traced exactly how they pulled the trigger. It comes down to a specific genetic pathway called the XRP1-TOR apoptosis axis.
That is quite a mouthful.
It is. But basically, XRP1 is a transcription factor, a protein that controls the rate of transcription of genetic information. When a cell lacks ribosomal proteins, it experiences severe stress, which activates XRP1.
So XRP1 is essentially the cell's internal distress flare.
Exactly. But a distress flare alone doesn't actually kill the cell.
Yeah.
The presence of the fitter trisomic neighbor alters the local signaling pathways, particularly the MTOR pathway, which regulates cell growth and survival.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. The trisomic neighbor essentially senses the weakness, reads the distress flare, and pushes the monosomic cell's internal signaling over the edge into apoptosis, which is programmed irreversible cell death.
That is wild. The stronger neighbor forces the weaker one to hit its own self-destruct button.
It's brutal.
It's terrifying. But then the researchers looked at a different region of the chromosome, which they labeled region 1. And they found an interaction that is even more aggressive. They called it super competition.
Oh yeah, region 1 completely breaks the rules we just established.
How so?
Well, in this genomic region, there are no known haploinsufficient ribosomal genes. The protein factories are totally fine, yet the monosomic cells were still being wiped out.
Wait, why?
The difference here was the behavior of the trisomic cells. They didn't just survive, they actively overproliferated. They grew abnormally large, aggressively stealing physical space and resources at the direct expense of the monosomic cells.
They basically turned into microscopic mob bosses.
That's a great way to put it.
The extra genetic dose turned the trisomic cells into super competitors. But how do they physically do that without just relying on the weaker cell having broken ribosomes?
So the researchers narrowed this mob boss behavior down to a small genomic region containing about 179 genes. And one gene in particular really stood out. the flower gene or fruit.
The flower gene.
Yeah. The flower gene encodes a transmembrane protein. This means the protein sits directly on the outer surface of the cell membrane. It acts as a literal fitness code or barcode, displaying the cell's status to the outside world.
So it's like a physical handshake between neighbors.
A deadly handshake. When the cell membranes touch, these flower proteins interact. If the trisomic cell's barcode indicates it has a higher fitness level, which is driven by the extra copies of genes in region 1, it triggers a toxic chemical cascade inside the neighboring monosomic cell, killing it.
Wow.
Now, the paper does note that simply artificially overexpressing the flower gene didn't completely reproduce the full super competition effect.
So it's not acting alone.
Right. This suggests it's a cumulative effort. Multiple genes in that specific region are likely working together to turn the cell into a true super competitor.
Okay, so just when you think you have the rules of the neighborhood figured out, you know, monosomy equals weak, trisomy equals enforcer, they found a third mechanism that completely flips the script.
Oh, region 2.
Yes, region 2, where they witnessed growth compensation.
This was a truly unexpected, highly counterintuitive finding. In region 2, the monosomic cells were struggling on their own. But when their trisomic twins were present, the monosomic cells suddenly showed no growth defect at all.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Instead of executing the weaker cells, the trisomic cells actually rescued them.
They act as martyrs. That is, yeah. I mean, how does a cell with extra DNA rescue a dying neighbor?
It is a process known as compensatory proliferation. The trisomic cells in region 2 appear to be highly sensitive to having three copies of the specific genes located there. The extra genetic load is literally toxic to them, and they begin to die off. And as they undergo apoptosis and basically burst open, they secrete potent survival and growth signals into the surrounding tissue.
They're essentially feeding these struggling monosomic cells on their way out.
They are. The surrounding monosomic cells absorb those secreted chemical signals, which stimulates them to grow and effectively rescues them from elimination.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is a non-autonomous effect, meaning the rescue depends entirely on factors produced outside the monosomic cell itself.
So, depending entirely on which specific genes are unbalanced, a trisomic cell can be an executioner, a supervillain taking over the neighborhood, or a martyr sacrificing itself to save its twin.
Exactly. The interactions are incredibly localized and context dependent. And if we pull back and connect all of these varied mechanisms to the bigger picture, the implications are just profound.
Right.
Think back to your opening paradox about the human embryo.
The fact that over 80% of early embryos are riddled with these chaotic aneuploid cells, yet somehow produce healthy babies.
Right. This fierce microscopic turf war, this cell competition, might be the exact mechanism the developing body uses to successfully clean out those dangerous cells.
So the body uses the chaos to fix the chaos.
Basically. The trisomic twins, generated by early natural division errors, might act as the necessary enforcers. They identify and kill off the weaker monosomic cells, sacrificing themselves or cleaning house to ensure only the healthy euploid cells go on to form the fetus.
It is quite literally survival of the fittest happening before we are even born.
It really is. But then there's the dark side of this coin, cancer.
Right, we mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. If you are picturing a tumor as just a lump of fast-growing cells, this completely shifts the paradigm. Think of a tumor instead as an actively aggressive neighbor hijacking these exact systems.
Okay, explain that.
Well, if a somatic cell in an adult acquires an extra chromosome that gives it that super competitor status we saw in region 1, it doesn't just grow fast. It uses mechanisms like the flower gene to aggressively wipe out the surrounding healthy tissue.
It's purposefully clearing physical space.
Exactly. Clearing space and stealing resources for the tumor to expand.
And what about the vulnerability of the monosomies, that haploinsufficiency? Is that playing a role in cancer too?
That is equally dangerous. If a perfectly healthy cell, perhaps one acting as a crucial tumor suppressor, accidentally loses one copy of a gene, the surrounding tissue might mistakenly label it a loser.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the natural quality control system kills off the very cell trying to protect the organ, accidentally clearing the way for cancer to thrive. It reframes tumor development entirely. It's really about how a mutated cell manipulates its neighbors.
As incredibly revealing as this is, I always want to make sure we understand the boundaries of the study. We are looking at a highly specific model in fruit flies. What are the actual limitations here?
The authors are remarkably transparent about the constraints, which is great. First, there is an inherent time limitation. The study observed the imaginal discs of the larvae, which only grow for about 72 hours before the larva enters metamorphosis.
So we're only seeing a 72-hour snapshot.
Precisely. Meaning, we don't know what those resilient trisomic cells would do if they were left alone for, say, a month. If they were allowed to persist over a longer timeline, the cumulative proteotoxic stress might eventually catch up to them.
Or they might become fully malignant.
Right. We simply can't track long-term effects in this model. The second major limitation involves the twin spot generator technique itself.
Because it forces the twins to be created side by side.
Right. Because the mitotic recombination generates the trisomy and the monosomy simultaneously, it is incredibly difficult to completely disentangle the effect of trisomy living entirely on its own without its monosomic twin nearby.
They're a package deal.
Exactly. The chemical signaling and physical interactions are so rapid and deeply entangled that isolating the pure isolated effect of just the chromosome gain remains a significant technical challenge.
Which leads perfectly into where the field goes from here. Mm. What are the immediate next steps?
Well, researchers must determine if these exact competitive interactions, the lethal competition and the super competition, actually occur in human embryos during early development. We need to verify if human trisomic cells act as these necessary enforcers.
And what about therapies?
That's the other big step. Understanding mechanisms like compensatory proliferation could open up entirely new therapeutic targets.
I mean, if we can figure out the exact chemical growth signals a dying cell uses to support its neighbors, we might be able to block those signals therapeutically in a tumor environment, right?
Yay.
Basically starving the cancer of that rescue mechanism.
Exactly. We are no longer just trying to kill the cancer cell. We are trying to disrupt the neighborhood communication network that allows it to survive in the first place.
Well, to wrap all this up, the depletion of genetically imbalanced cells isn't just some isolated malfunction where a broken cell simply, you know, quietly dies on its own. It is driven by a fierce microscopic turf war.
It really is.
Through cell competition, the physical and chemical interactions between neighboring aneuploid cells ultimately decide the survival and health of the entire tissue.
Yeah, it is a dynamic, socially complex cellular environment where the balance of power is constantly being negotiated based on genetic fitness.
What does this mean for our ability to harness cell competition to stop cancer before it even starts?
Yeah. It's a huge question.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base. Under white lab lights, the numbers start to breathe. Signals in the static, patterns underneath. Across 1,000 samples, the story starts to form. When the measures move together, something real is born. We track the rise, we track the fall. A hidden rhythm in it all. Not just noise on a screen, but what the clusters mean. Read the pulse in the data, let it lead the way. When the markers line up, we don't look away. If the metrics start talking, we're learning to listen. From the trend to the truth, watch the system go missing. That won't recede, and the covering pieces show the shape of need. Types and reported outcomes
future's in the decision.